You're listening to the Karamcast episode 4, where I am going to be interviewing a very special guest, our intrepid writer from musiczeitgeist.com, Truffle Jones, who's been out all over the town for the last week doing the week of shows. Truffle, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, the week of shows. This time of year, the fall, generally what happens is all of the bands who are kind of up and coming and don't really have the wherewithal, this drawing power to compete with the big summer concerts, they all hit the road in the fall. And as a music lover, what that means is essentially it's kind of a feast for all of these great bands, an opportunity to see them live. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, they tend to all tour on top of each other. And here in Los Angeles, we tend to get every single band coming through because of the importance of the market. So the week of shows is pretty much every single night going out, seeing one or two bands, and just trying to give a perspective on what's happening out there.
A lot of people wrote in after the last couple of podcasts when we were asking what they'd like to hear more about, and they said they wanted to hear about what was going on in the music scene here, I suppose, because Los Angeles is a breeding ground or a launching pad for so many bands that then spread across the continent and become an integral part of everybody's listening schedule until they're discarded and the next one's picked up. What do you think is coming down the pipe?
Really, it's funny because this week probably best personifies, you know, that exact trend. A lot of bands that don't have an opportunity to come from overseas and visit the States, that's a great thing to look at right now. There's a band called Noah and the Whale that I'm looking forward to seeing tomorrow night. They're kind of a UK pop export. And they're getting, you know, some good attention, some good buzz, and haven't really showed up on the blogs yet, so we'll see about that. A band that I've reviewed for Music Zeitgeist, Mr. Gnome. This is a husband and wife duo who play guitar and drums only, and it's heavily steeped in the tradition of Black Sabbath and Tool in terms of the intensity of the music. And the vocals, the girl who sings really has more of kind of the softer Lisa Germano, Hope Sandoval voice, and it really creates an interesting dynamic. They're great fun, super to watch live. Definitely in the last few months, they seem to be picking up some steam as well.
Yeah, we had a chance to listen to them, and I have to tell you how much I immediately enjoyed the song I heard. You've covered that band twice on musiczeitgeist.com. I'm hoping we can have the opportunity to play some of it on our podcast. You're exposed to so much indie music. Do you think that that term is still a term owned by the English language, or is it one that's been completely co-opted by pop cultural circles to the point where it's now capital I indie, and it sounds like a very specific identifiable sound, much like the poor word alternative had bestowed upon it 15 years ago?
Oh, for certain. Definitely we saw that happen with the phrase alternative. Before alternative, you know, in the late 80s, if you listen to bands like Depeche Mode or My Bloody Valentine or The Cure, back then those bands were called progressive before they're even called alternative. And so there's always been some term or another to identify bands that are supposedly on kind of the outside of the mainstream. And then inevitably what happens is as those bands penetrate the mainstream, that phrase kind of loses whatever cultural currency it possesses. And in terms of the phrase indie music or independent music, it was always, I think, more a description of the DIY ethic and major label movement for artists who just wanted to get their music out there and truly independent of kind of the machinations of the music industry.
So do you think the word indie was destined to become a genre because of the fact that when you have these artists that are essentially recording outside of the label system and are on meager budgets, that there's going to be a consistency in the lo-fi sound? Or is that just something that eventually became, you know, it's either beat them or join them if you want to get covered by the blogs, the zines, and all the scenesters? then you're going to have to kind of get on side with the other bands that are forging ahead with a certain sound.
I think it's and there are elements of both at play there. You can certainly go back and look at a band like Pavement and go, oh, well, Pavement was this incredible indie band. And, you know, they're so groundbreaking and their sound was lo-fi. And all of that is true, but at the same time, they weren't exactly independent the way I think in recent years we've tended to come and think of mad artists toiling away in their basements on laptops, burning CDs that same day, playing a show and throwing it up on MySpace. I think that's the more recent embodiment of the term, but at the same time, it's also become a marketing term. The same way that when we talk about things that are green right now in United States culture has become a marketing term.
Does this mean that indie music is dead?
No, absolutely not. It just means that how we refer to artists who are kind of operating on shoestring budgets and really doing whatever they can to manifest their creative vision is just going to become known as something else. There'll be another phrase for it. Independent music or indie music, I mean, it's still going to be around. It's not going to go away. We're not going to bury it in a grave the way Rick Rubin did with the phrase deaf years ago. But it just doesn't mean what it used to mean. And I think you can see the major labels in their frustration using that term again as a marketing phrase to try and intimate some kind of purity or some kind of artistic integrity with bands that 5 or 10 years ago just would have kind of gotten the straight up major label push, kind of the saccharine delivery of, you know, here's another artist that we believe you need to hear.
Indie as a term and all the bands that like to lump themselves underneath that so emphatically is really not this sacred cow that it would have you believe, you know, as the kids that are listening on their iPods and their Zunes and their BitTorrents and everything else are flocking around it and then eating it and discarding it and like a giant earthworm moving through this pile of incumbent MP3 sludge. The Robert Plant Alison Krauss record produced by T-Bone Burnett is something that comes out and it sounds to me as fresh and out of the mainstream and innovative and intimate as any record would claim to ever be. And it's made by a bunch of old fogies, you know, who've been around forever. But that's the stuff that really, I would say, a lot of those bands are kind of aspiring to, or they're intimating. What differentiates a T-Bone Burnett record from the wannabe cowboys that you watched at the Silver Lake Lounge last night?
Well, I think the biggest thing to realize in that kind of comparison is you're looking at years and years of experience and lots of money behind an effort that is, I hesitate to say luxury, but it's definitely a product and a project, for that matter, that is executed deliberately and as fast as slow as they want to do something like that. That comes with having all of that history behind you and really having the ability to invest as much time or as little time as you want. The kind of slackery bands that you're referring to are kind of the bands that are in whatever movement right now in the zeitgeist, quite literally. They don't have that luxury of time. If they have a particular sound that's unique and is resonating culturally, they kind of have to act fast. And they kind of have to make good on whatever promise that first attention-getting effort makes. And I would say a great example, it's a mainstream example, but it definitely plays. Look at the career of the Killers. Here's a band that, if you put on Hot Fuss today, it sounds a little dated because they were kind of emerging right out of the 80s synthy kind
revival,
of resurgence.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so what they had to do was immediately come out with something that was still the Killers, but yet had stepped 1 or 2 feet away from that so they wouldn't always be lumped into that. And they did that. You know, commercially, maybe their second record was a bit of a failing, but artistically, they're going to be able to put out a third record and a fourth record. You can say the same for a band like Interpol. And a band that didn't fare as well, The Stills. The Stills came out the same time, and they also had kind of that 80s kind of synthy sound that the other two aforementioned bands had. And they went and came back with a second record that's just steeped in Dylan, you know, and went on tour wearing plaid flannel shirts a couple of years ago.
And opened for Paul McCartney.
Exactly, and so they went a completely different route. Commercially less viable, but at the same time, that's really kind of the difference between when we talk about Plant and Krauss doing what they're doing with an album produced by T-Bone versus what some of these other bands have to do to try and make good on, you know, their promise as artists. Otherwise, they just get flushed down the toilet.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. I mean, I'm just saying, hey, be wary out there. If you're one of the young whippersnappers making music these days, don't worry about the scenesters around you. Just don't worry about it, because that whole thing can get just wiped away like by a set of windshield wipers, and it'll just make room for the thing that's coming after you, and all of a sudden you're going to be looking around and saying, how did I become the old dude? You got to keep it fresh. You got to listen to something that really happens inside of you, and that's about as important as it gets. Case in point, we went to see Sigur Rós at the Greek, and there was nothing about that that was derivative of anything else going on in music right now. Absolutely nothing. I mean, beyond the fact that Jonesy, the lead singer, was playing his Les Paul with a violin bow, the music was completely something unto itself. And we were discussing how they're not signed and they never really had any major radio play. Getting to the point that they're at now, which is selling out the Greek and consistently, and they sort of became recognizable perhaps through licensing to films and television shows. But even then, you know, there's not like an identifiable hook, except that now we've heard it so many times that you can recognize it from outside the stadium. When you're walking towards, you say, oh yeah, that's got to be Sigur Rós. I recognize that. There's a lot of room for that sort of thing to succeed, so you got to keep the margins as wide as possible. And remember that in a time like this, when there really are no defined rules, there's a lot of how-tos and maybe you shoulds, but there's no actual restrictions or parameters. Everybody's guessing, and there is no center. It's completely decentralized. You have more freedom than you could ever have imagined right now to do things however you want and still have an opportunity to have them heard.
That's exactly the point, though. The point is that, like you just said, there are no parameters, and you have a lot of people guessing. The people who are guessing are always going to be the people who are failing. When you look at a band like Sigur Rós, I can guarantee you they did not sit around 10 years ago in Iceland and say, hey, What's the best kind of record we can make right now to get noticed and burrow under the skins of people so we can have a 10-odd-year career? They simply had a vision that they wanted to bring forth into the world. That's what they chose to do. And for whatever reason, it took hold. But that's the correct way to succeed. You can bet they don't sit around at night and second-guess themselves about whether or not they made the right artistic decision, because they've only made the right artistic decision, and that's the one that worked for them. Music as it stands today, people complain about, they lament about the old music industry and how it's ruined and downloading is made a nightmare out of everything. But if you ask me, right now has got to be the most exciting time to be a musician.
Ever.
Ever. I mean, no other time in history has provided such an easy way to have your music experienced by so many people so instantaneously. And because people have the ability to be filters for themselves and not rely on radio and mainstream press and so forth, the cream of the crop is going to make itself apparent. And really, the only kind of drawback to what's happening right now is that there's so much music. A band that's at the top of their game and at the peak of their popularity today, that might mean that they're headlining the El Rey instead of 20 years ago, where that kind of same interest might have put them at the Forum, which sounds like a huge disparity, but really it's not, because there are so many bands and there's so much interest and everything's so easy to get your hands on.
How many bands actually break via primarily internet marketing tactics, self-marketing tactics, versus how many independent bands are breaking because they're out in the clubs playing every week?
That's really a great question. And actually, later on this week, Margo and the Nuclear So-and-Sos is going to be releasing two albums. And that's one of the exact questions I wanted to ask them. And the reason why is because they have a brutal road schedule. These guys are constantly on tour. It's like a never-ending tour. I don't think there's really a beginning or end. And at the same time, there's this proliferation of material on the internet. I mean, this is a band where you can go and download any number of live shows. You can go and download demo versions of songs. And it's really, I don't know the answer, but it's really interesting to look at that as kind of a model. You know, are you the guy who sits in your bedroom and you just put a ton of stuff on the internet? And
like David Garza, maybe?
Yeah, and try and get in the right places and hope that the acclaim comes? Or do you go and you play to eight people every night for a year straight in a crappy van and eat Subway every day and hope little by little you can get a foothold and people will come back the next time.
It's got to be a combination of both, I'm guessing, because you are invariably going to be preaching to the choir. If you do anything the same way for too long, you're going to plateau. It's not just a critical mass, but some kind of catalyst that's unexpected comes into the picture, and the whole thing just does that evolutionary quantum leap, if that's not an oxymoron. It has to do that thing where it just jumps out of one place and completely shifts into a different space. And I can't see that just sitting there adding 5,000 MySpace friends every night to your profile is going to do that. But I also can't really see that because of the decentralization of media and the stranglehold that the companies have on the mainstream media, that playing 8-person-a-night shows across the country is going to work on its own either. You've got to get the bloggers writing about you. You've got to get that cross-pollination going on with the social networks and so on.
Well, no question about it. I would say, just to kind of add on to that, you know, the one thing is you can look back through history and there's always been hundreds, if not thousands, of bands that have just been slugging it out in the clubs. I think that paradigm has always been in existence. What's different now is that because of the way things have shifted away from major label marketing programs and exposure on mainstream media, and because there are so many choices to be made, for example, this week, the week of shows, in a given week about who you can see, there's more of an emphasis on being a great live performer. You have a short opportunity when you take the stage to make a very long-lasting impression. So I think the best bands and the bands that are going to be most successful are the ones who don't simply come out and recreate the recorded music on stage, but they're the bands who are going to do so in a fashion that makes it completely memorable, ideally interactive, so the audience can really kind of graft onto what's happening. And then when they go away, when they leave that town with recorded music kind of in their wake, give people something to revisit that's quality enough for them to say, wow, you know, this band, I really enjoy them live. I'm going to listen to their record over and over because they had such a great experience. And that's
Are you talking about an actual CD?
Well, it doesn't, of course, have to be a CD. I mean, you can go to...
But does seeing a band live somehow make you more amenable to wanting to listen to an actual CD versus if you discovered them on iMeme, kind of leaving it in the realm of streaming and downloads?
Absolutely. And I don't, you know, this is a point I think many could argue, but let's take a look at what's happening right now with vinyl. There's this huge resurgence in the popularity of vinyl. When you look at what's happened in the last 20 years, we have a whole generation of music lovers who grew up not knowing what an album was. We have further another generation who's growing up not really knowing what a CD was. You know, just really having access to music on the internet and then on their iPods or their MP3 players. But the fact that there's a resurgence in the interest of vinyl, and the fact that if you go to a place like Amoeba Records and you're selling them CDs or you're selling them vinyl, you're going to get paid more for your vinyl, tells us that people want to have that kind of tangible experience with their music. They want to experience it more than just kind of in their crappy earbuds.
Do you?
Absolutely.
I know that's true about vinyl. I know it's definitely not true about a CD. I don't ever enjoy dealing with CD as a media. On the other hand, I always miss my Technics turntable, and I always miss pulling the vinyl out of the slipcase. So it's not necessarily, in my opinion, the fact that it's tactile or tangible. It's the kind of thing that it is. I mean, I certainly don't pine for an 8-track player either. There's something about vinyl itself that is amazing, and it sounds really great, and there's something also about vinyl, like a cassette tape, where it has sides. You have side A and you have side B, and there's this kind of intermission, and how did the artist decide to split it up, which affects the kind of play sequence that there's going to be. CDs at first followed that, and then playlists became their own kind of thing, as CD was this linear medium. But there's something about vinyl that I think is independent of CDs that makes people, that I could make the argument, yes, people like the tactile thing. I don't always believe that they're necessarily liking purchasing a CD from somebody over downloading the iTunes album.
Oh, no, I would definitely not ever say that that was the case. I mean, and the numbers clearly speak. you know, in favor against that. But I would also say, and maybe not, let's not specifically talk about getting back to the point of seeing a band live, about a CD or vinyl per se, but you know, bands make a lot of their money right now, so much so, in fact, that the record labels have glommed onto it, by playing live shows and selling merchandise. And so when you see a band live and they make an impression on you, you have the opportunity to, maybe it's buy music, but also, you know, it's a sticker, it's a shirt, whatever it is, a button, a hat, you take that home with you and it becomes part of your environment at home. And suddenly this band is more present in your daily life than any number of other bands that just exist on your computer hard drive.
Absolutely.
And that's what makes the difference.
The audience, that's a great point. Of course, we want you to bring our brand home and be reminded of it every day. And on the other side, from the fan's perspective, I know that there's a kind of proof of having been there that is exciting. That's why you make that exchange. That's why you make the transaction. You say, I have to get a t-shirt from this Pixies reunion tour or from this My Bloody Valentine reunion tour or whatever it is so that I can say I was there and you weren't. So there's this kind of proof of merit thing that I think is why merch does so well at a live show. And the more niche-y, the smaller, the more underground the show is, or the rarer the likelihood of that kind of a show going on, the more valuable the merchant transaction becomes.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, two of the shows that I've seen this week, My Bloody Valentine and A Pretender's Acoustic In-Store, I saw at both a lot of old merch, a lot of old t-shirts. And you're right, there is a certain amount of snobbery to the point of comeuppance between fans where they want to say in a passive way, I'm a better fan than you, or I'm a bigger fan than you, or I'm cooler than you because I was there when this shit happened the first time around.
Yep.
And you see, and that's when you see you know, the old, like you just said, a Pixies reunion shirt, which is great until you run into somebody who's wearing an original Pixies shirt from 1989. And it's kind of, I've trumped you with my 1989 Pixies shirt.
To the interest of the artists that might be listening to this, that's something to be said for the kind of merch you're making. You can make a t-shirt or a hoodie that's just got your name on it, or you can make a t-shirt or hoodie that's got a reason for being there that identifies either the year or the tour or the album or whatever it is. But you know, the less general, in fact the more specific it is, the more valuable it's likely to become.
Absolutely. That type of mentality, if you really have a devoted fan base, or you're trying to incur a devoted fan base, that is the best way to make your merch collectible. That's the best way to have, instead of someone buying a single shirt one time, if there's enough different qualities between the tours or between the different shirts you even have available right then and there, you're really going to inspire people to continually buy. You're going to inspire a repeat customer as long as they like your band and remain loyal to you as an artist.
I just want to go back for a second and talk about My Bloody Valentine this week at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. You had a chance to go and see that show, highly anticipated. How was it?
It was everything that I think a My Bloody Valentine fan could have wanted or could have hoped for, seeing them, you know, 15 odd years after the fact. And in that, just basically saying that nothing changed. They picked up right where they left off. Everything that they previously delivered live, which if you weren't fortunate enough to see them back then, you had to kind of rely on bootlegs and stuff. They reproduced everything live and sounded amazing. And it was a really kind of a no-frills affair. They came out, they crushed everybody's skulls, and they left. It was really something special.
But when Loveless came out in 1991, was it?
Loveless did come out in 1991, that's correct.
They were playing to a generation, if we want to catalog generations, that was one of the smallest populations in a long, long time. It was the Generation X coming into the Clinton era, post-modernity, pre-Nirvana and grunge and all of that. Now they're playing to a post-George W. Bush administration generation. Everybody's got a BlackBerry. I mean, when Loveless came out, there wasn't even an internet available to the general public. So what was the audience like? Was it the same audience 15 years older, or was it a new generation of listeners? How did the music feel now versus how it would have felt back then?
It's interesting. The audience was definitely a mix of older people who maybe experienced or appreciated My Bloody Valentine 10, 15, 20 years ago, and also a lot of younger people who clearly have only discovered them in recent years. And, you know, it's one thing when you go see a band that has a little history. I did a Cure review several months ago. And you look at the band and you go, wow, this material has aged extremely well. It still holds up, etc. Versus seeing My Bloody Valentine, it's not even an issue of whether or not the material aged. They're just so far completely outside of the idiom that calling it timeless doesn't even do it justice. I mean, it's as vital today as it ever was.
What is it about MBV that makes it feel timeless?
I would hesitate to quantify in terms of the quality of the music and what makes up their songs, because I think that's highly subjective. I mean, every listener is going to have a different experience, but they created and inspired subsequently a sound that was as anti-now at the time as they possibly could have conceived, particularly in the late 80s, early 90s, when you're looking at a lot of synth and drum machine-oriented dance music. Rock music in that time period wasn't really rock music the way we think of it, particularly post-grunge. And so when they kind of delved into more of a ethereal realm, but then rooted with kind of this bombastic, earthy drive underneath it, they did something that was completely outside of the context of then. I mean, look at what's happening right now in music. It's pretty much outside of the context of now. I mean, there's been a little bit of what's called a shoegaze revival, but nobody even comes close conceptually to what My Bloody Valentine was doing. And today, a lot of the landscape is kind of dominated by, there's a huge folk resurgence right now. A lot of singer-songwriters, but also like a lot of just folk-based music, like the Fleet Foxes, who just played through a few weeks ago. So contextually, again, My Bloody Valentine is just operating outside of anything that's happening right now. If you listen to the radio stations out here, be it the indie one, like the NPR-based one, KCRW, or the commercial stations, K-Rock or Indie 103, you're not going to hear anything that sounds like My Bloody Valentine.
Let me say that one of the things that creates a burst of identifiable music as a period is melody. And for example, when you had Third Eye Blind and Blink 182 and Matchbox 20 all happening, there was this consistency between the melodies that they would use in their songs. Similarly, when Stone Temple Pilots came out post Nirvana, and then you had Pearl Jam, there's also an identifiable set of melodic choices that are made. And even now, when you've got everything from Interpol and The Editors and Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, there's another thing that's going on there that calls back to Ian Curtis and Joy Division and so on. Those things, in a way, group these periods and artists together in a way that they may or may not be identifying themselves, or they're doing this cross-referential thing. But My Bloody Valentine, when they put out Loveless, really blurred the lines between melody and ambience and the technology itself, where they would be warbling the actual 2-inch tape that was playing back. And it's very, very difficult to pluck out a specific melody. I know that from their recording notes, they would sometimes have, you know, 18, 20 tracks of guitars or vocals layered on top of each other. You could never quite identify what the lyrics were. Do you think that contributes to its timelessness?
Yeah, I mean, you pretty much have said succinctly what I failed to say, which is that, you know, a lot of bands that try to do now what My Bloody Valentine did kind of only get their foot one step inside the door in terms of delivering the denseness and the wall of sound and the layered guitars and lots of droning and feedback and so forth. But kind of buried within My Bloody Valentine, there is a strong sense of melody. And I mean, you can whistle any My Bloody Valentine song the same way you can whistle other pop songs. It's just not that apparent upon first listen. And I think that, you're right, absolutely kind of contributes to not only the resurgence in popularity, but just kind of the continued relevance of that band. They do what they do in such an original way. Nobody's really been able to kind of come along and improve upon that.
Now, you've seen shows during the week of shows that are at all scales. So you've seen very intimate little shows like the John and Yeko show at On the Rocks, lead singer of ours, and you also saw things at the amphitheater and the Civic Auditorium. But if you put these bands on the same bills, would they match up? I mean, would they be able to play alongside each other? Or does the size of the venue itself, is it suited to the bands that are playing them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The venues, it's really interesting, actually. This week, the week of shows, has kind of inadvertently grown in scale, by which I mean on Monday, I was able to see Jimmy Gnecco of ours at On the Rocks, which is incredibly intimate, and to see the Pretenders do an acoustic set at Amoeba, also an intimate experience, although that room is kind of big, and seeing Beach House at Spaceland and seeing Mr. Gnome at Silver Lake Lounge, all really small places. And then as the week went on, suddenly it's My Bloody Valentine at the Santa Monica Civ, it's Cigaros at the Greek. Last night I was down at the Detour Festival, which is a full city block of downtown LA. And when you look at those settings and you look at the artists who are performing, it becomes very apparent who can pull off what. You couldn't put a band like Mr. Gnome on stage at the Greek Theater yet, because there's a certain level of stagecraft that comes with being put in the performance realm over and over and repeatedly, and learning out how to communicate with your audience, or not communicating with your audience for that matter.
Certainly the White Stripes are able to fill the Greek quite happily.
Absolutely, and to put on a great show. A perfect example of this is MGMT. Arguably the soundtrack to the summer of 2008. You couldn't escape it, and with good reason, and not that you'd want to escape it. It was just such a great album.
In fact, I called MGMT the future of music and the culture pin about a year ago, and then I saw some online YouTube videos of their performances, and I was quite disappointed by what I thought was one of the best albums in the last 5-10 years.
Absolutely, and it's not to slight MGMT at all artistically. It's just that you have a very young group who the first time they played here in LA, I believe, was at the Echoplex. And then just a few months later, they're playing the Hollywood Bowl, opening for Beck. And that type of environment is not something that you can just walk into and naturally be gifted at, you know, getting 18,000 people off with their music. It really takes a certain amount of stagecraft, and that has to be learned, and it has to kind of be honed. Conversely, seeing Nick Cave at the Hollywood Bowl, here's a guy who's been going at it for a couple of decades, and you know he's going to work you in a room of 300, or he's going to work you in a stadium. He absolutely has it down and knows how to connect with the audience.
Is he doing the same thing in both situations, just that he's got charisma, or is he modifying what he does to appeal to the different sizes of audience?
You know, I'm fortunate that I've seen him a bunch of times in all sorts of different venues. I've seen him in intimate little theaters, and I've seen him in the bigger arena or amphitheater setting as well. And he absolutely changes it up. And that's part of what makes him successful as an artist. A lot of people love him because of his recorded music, and certainly there's a lot to choose from. You know, he has so many albums. But to see him live, it's very difficult to walk away and feel like he wasn't there to entertain you.
I have to say, though, I'm a musician myself, and I've played everything from acoustic cafes to large-scale venues, and sometimes the excitement really comes when you've actually overworked a situation. I've played, for example, with a band in small venues, let's say one time too many, and then all of a sudden, when we're given the proper PA and the proper sound man and the proper monitoring setup and the light show and everything, and you hear that kick just rattling the walls, then you realize, wow, we've been ready for this size the whole time. We've just been playing ourselves in these smaller rooms. So who's to say that Mr. Gnome put up at the amphitheater at the Greek all of a sudden wouldn't just be everything you could have ever wanted and more?
I mean, you're right. It's subjective. It's just my opinion that I'm, you know, kind of presenting. But I'll give you another interesting example. This week, Friday, I saw Dandy Warhol's play at the Wiltern, which is a relatively small theater. And keep in mind, this is a band that plays festivals in Europe and kind of has experienced unbridled popularity there over the years.
What's the capacity of the Wiltern, just so people who haven't seen it get an idea?
I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly, but around 2,000.
So 2,000 is not exactly a small theater by some people's standards, but it's compared to the Staples Center, it's small.
It's Staples Center, 14,000 to 18,000 people, depending on how it's set up. But it's certainly no Glastonbury. It's certainly not a 30,000-person festival overseas. So to talk about what you were just addressing, you would think a band with that type of experience playing such big gigs would be able to come and just kind of kill it in a smaller setting like that. And that, for whatever reason, was not the case. There really was kind of a lack of connectivity between the audience and the group. And that's not just me seeing it or saying it. Again, I think a lot of people left. I know a lot of people left partway through. I was watching them do it. And so you have to kind of wonder, okay, well, if there's something to performing that's more than just playing your songs, where was it that night? And why didn't it manifest that night? To your point of, well, maybe a band just kind of shows up and they have it and they had it in it the whole time, that maybe is not necessarily the case. It certainly didn't seem to be on Friday.
Is that because of the set list that they chose, or is it their attitudes? Or it seems to me that they were a bit cynical about playing in Hollywood.
Well, there are a lot of artists who just don't like Los Angeles and Hollywood in general, and that could very well have been part of it. My sense was that the set list was just uneven, and there were too many peaks and valleys, and the people who were there, who paid money to be there, wanted to kind of have a good time that they weren't able to have. And it's not to slight the Dandy Warhols. I mean, I can only review one event that I'm seeing. I love the Dandy Warhols. That's why I went out of my way to go see them. You know, I enjoy them as artists, and I have gotten a couple of comments, and people go, why are you so negative on Beach House? Why are you so negative on the Dandy Warhols? Well, I'm not. I'm not out to get anybody. I can only report what I see. And that's part of trying to report on live music and make it interesting. That's part of the challenge that, you know, we're undergoing right now and trying to make Music Zeitgeist interesting and vital. You can look at the LA Times review or an LA Weekly review, and there's just nothing to it. When I was younger, I had the opportunity to work with writers who were reviewing music events, and I got to watch these guys kind of show up, watch two or three songs, go back to a media room and kind of write some stuff on their laptop, smoke a cigarette, have a beer, flirt with some girls, maybe watch one other song, and then leave. And then you read the review the next day, and it seems like they were here the whole time. You know, they seem like they watched the whole show. And there's just kind of that really basic black and white journalistic approach to looking at live music, which I find is greatly uninspiring when you're trying to translate what you saw, like what we were just talking about with the Dandy Warhols.
Yeah, I can certainly say that we're not paid media journalists. We are definitely the guys that are down in the pit and checking it out and reporting back the visceral nature of the experience as best we can. I'm from Toronto originally. You're from...
From the Midwest.
You're from the Midwest. And when you see shows in those places, things are very different. The audiences respond differently. I know for a fact that in Toronto, albeit being a very large city that sees an enormous influx of shows every year because it's a major hub in Canada, everybody makes pit stop there. It's just a complete gluttony in terms of how many concerts you can go see of the highest order. But there's still a kind of reverence for these artists. There's this awe and, oh my God, can you believe that Ministry is coming to town for their last tour? Or can you believe that? And somebody like Mr. Gnome would be a big deal up in Toronto. In Los Angeles, it's a great city itself. It doesn't get starstruck. And that's a benefit in a lot of cases because it means you really got to step up to the plate and really just show what you are for who you are. There isn't a lot of mythos surrounding you, but it's definitely two very different experiences, and I believe that can certainly affect your overall reaction to the show.
No question about it. And you can be standing at a show in Los Angeles and watching whoever the artist is that you're watching, and you're standing among artists who are just as big, if not bigger, or perhaps you know them, and perhaps you're going to go to their house afterward and have some after hours or whatever. And to a degree, that makes people pretty jaded on playing in Los Angeles, having talked to artists who have come through. They feel that audiences tend to be indifferent. And maybe that's true. Maybe the apathy is just like you said, the failure to be starstruck. How difficult is it for you to get into a show when you're standing next to, you know, Martin Gore, and you're going to go back up to his pad in Santa Barbara after the show? Probably pretty difficult to invest yourself in that show and to be impressed by any form of performance or musicality. But at the same time, that's what makes it a beautiful place, because the expectations just aren't there. Like you said, there really aren't any mythos surrounding a band when they blow into town, the same way maybe when a band plays Peoria would experience.
That's one of the reasons I keep a base here in Los Angeles, because it's very sobering. You really don't get away with a lot of bullshit. on the other side of it, one of the interesting quirks is when we go to a show, let's say, for example, PJ Harvey, and you look around in the audience and there's Beck and there's Morrissey and they're just fans. They're just straight in the audience because they're fans of these artists. And that, I have to say, does create a kind of reverence within me that's like, geez, like, I can't believe that Courtney Love is just showing up just because she's so blown away by this artist.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that comes with being in this town. And it actually can work to an artist's favor as well from a PR perspective. And that's, unfortunately, that's an aspect of the music industry that's never going to go away, is the love Hollywood has for musicians and actors and what they're doing and what they're up to and who they're doing it with. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you can go to an event like that and see people of that caliber there. And like you said, just being fans, for whatever reason, our fascination is with celebrity, good, bad, or indifferent. There are a lot of people who are going to say, oh, cool, you know, this celebrity is a fan, as am I. And they're going to feel more connected and feel like they have more contact, and the show is going to be a better experience.
Celebrities are a kind of ambassador for a way of thinking, a way of living, and they represent things. Courtney Love certainly has, she imports an awful lot of associations. She comes from a legacy that means a lot of things to a lot of people. It's very charged. When she shows up at a Pauly Jean Harvey concert, that means something. When Beck shows up at a Pauly Jean Harvey concert and he's standing three seats over, that also means something that the two of them would be there. There are these ambassadors for a set of meanings, and putting them side by side says that this artist that they're watching is able to play across that spectrum. And whereas if everybody that was there was, you know, a member of Pigface, you'd say, okay, I get it, they play to this kind of crowd. So it's not just being starstruck. It's not just that, oh, I saw them on TV or they sold X number of units. It's that they also represent something, and that there are these touchstones for those sets of meaning, I think.
I agree. I would add, though, conversely, that type of currency kind of has an expiration the bigger the artist gets, by which I mean there's certainly no risk in being a fan of Coldplay or of Radiohead or of Pearl Jam or, you know, U2. And if you want to see some star-studded events, go see any one of those concerts in Los Angeles. And we keep talking about them, and it's not specifically about them, but they're just a great example and a great band. But going to a Mr. Gnome show, it's just basically the people who are music lovers who kind of have gotten in on the ground floor of appreciating this band, and they're just coming out and checking them out and lending their support any way they can. At a certain point, like I said, I think the value of a celebrity or public figure kind of expires, because it just doesn't take that much effort to go see some of those bigger artists.
Yeah, and that's true. We briefly touched on the Detour Festival, but now let's get into the details of it. You saw Mars Volta play?
Saw the Mars Volta last night. They effectively closed the Detour Festival. I mean, there are other artists who were still playing at the same time electronically, but they were essentially the big headliner this year.
How'd they do?
They were incredible. I mean, you have to have a certain appreciation for their type of music. And if you don't, it's not something that you're going to walk into and just immediately love. That's very easy. The review that I wrote for the Detour Festival calls them a combination of Rage Against the Machine with Hendrix and Joplin by way of Bitches Brew era Miles Davis. That doesn't sound like a very easy thing to get into.
No mention of Rush and all of that?
Well, you know, if I was going to compare or include another prog rock band, I wouldn't use Rush as much as maybe I would use the less masturbatory era Primus, because the rhythms that Mars Volta can put down are pretty obtuse, where Rush's tend to be a little more mathematic, I think, not to get all academic about it. Mars Volta is incredibly visceral. I mean, it's just really a primal, elemental experience, where something like Rush is more something you stand back and appreciate, I think.
I mean, I don't know why I'm playing this game, but Tool is another band that comes to mind when I think of Mars Volta, except I think of Tool as being extremely sort of tight and rigid time, although they do play with time signatures and everything. I'm saying all this because Mars Volta is an incredibly exciting project to me. I've been following along since the early At the Drive-In EPs.
Sure, yeah.
And I've just always been so gobsmacked by what these guys are doing in both English and in Spanish and in just every kind of meter. and their incredible musicianship and their versatility, you know, I can barely comment. All I can do is I'm sort of rendered back to trying to find associations so I can try to make some sense of it. I know people who've gone to see Mars Volta play and walked out saying it was a spiritual, transcendent experience, that they felt like they were high, that they, you know, all kinds of things that's just overwhelming. And I wonder how that translates to a street fair.
Well, it's interesting because and really to go back to what we were talking about a little bit ago about putting different artists into different rooms on different stages, walking around Detour, you could see bands that probably are very, very comfortable playing in a little club. Or even on a bigger stage, but indoors. When you're outside and you're on a stage and you're trying to project basically into this vast open area, it's a whole different story. And if you're playing to just a handful of people, it's incredibly apparent because you're looking out. And, you know, for a lot of the bands, they perform during daylight hours. So you're looking at a bunch of concrete and steel and maybe not so many people. Again, talking about stagecraft and being a great live performer, Mars Volta, it didn't really seem... that it made a difference. I mean, they came out, they just exploded the moment they stepped on stage. They had the biggest audience gathered for them, and it was nighttime by the time they took the stage as well, so they didn't have the same challenges as some of the earlier bands in the festival.
I think those guys could go up anywhere, anytime, and throw down like it's nobody's business.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, mentioning Rage Against the Machine, as I just did a second ago, I had the opportunity to see them open for U2 when U2 was doing their stadium tour about 10 years ago. And here is a band that is explosive as any. And just at Lollapalooza this year, playing for 75,000 people, or half of 75,000 people, as Wilco was on the other side of the park playing at the same time, you would never know that playing in a stadium setting before U2, they went over pretty limply. And again, I think it just kind of goes back to how many of those experiences an artist accumulates as they grow and how well they do in those situations and how well they can improve upon them the next time.
That's
they have
interesting
opportunity to do that.
I saw the Pixies open for U2 way back.
Octung Baby. Yeah, I saw them as well.
And I got to tell you, the Pixies, even though they don't make a very, very big sound, they just blew U2 out of the water, in my opinion. I was ready to leave halfway through U2 after seeing the Pixies do what they did. And that's because the Pixies are just so freaking interesting. I mean, U2 is, of course, you know, one of the great rock bands, but the Pixies are just so outside. And but at the same time, they're so catchy. And there's some charisma about just the combination of all of those four players on the stage. And, you know, these guys were playing small alternative rooms not too long before that, but they had no problem convincing those stadiums one after another. It wasn't a matter of intensity or the size of the sound or, you know, having strippers on the stage. It was just the band was just that good.
Well, again, I think you have to look at the songwriting.
Their songwriting is just anthemic by nature. You know, it's sort of, it all feels like an anthem, which is quite appropriate in a stadium.
Yeah, I agree. And also consider, too, to add to your point, Pixies playing in that type of environment is just the Pixies playing. There's none of the large-scale choreography that U2 had when they went on later. You know, the planned moments and the acoustic set and the satellite stage and bringing someone up out of the crowd and all of that, the kind of theatrical or operatic elements that make up arena rock. I had the opportunity to see Kings of Leon open for U2 not too long ago. All they can do is get up and play. They don't really get a light show. They don't have the best sound check. They don't have the best access to the full soundboard anyway. That is a great way for a band to prove their mettle or fail.
I think Kings of Leon is a worthy successor to the U2 opening slot. I'm not quite sure that Rage Against the Machine is as good a fit.
It wasn't at the time, but it made sense from an ideological standpoint.
Yeah, well, I don't know how much ideology has to do with anthem rock in the end. We should bring this to a close because we could gab on forever, but
days.
I do want to talk about Kings of Leon. You introduced me to Kings of Leon way, way back, and it took me a second to put on the record, and once I did, I was an instant convert. I bought the gown. I go to the ritual ceremony every morning, and their new record has come out just now, and it's definitely getting a little more polished. They're becoming more comfortable with being at a label. But I want to hear your thoughts about the new album.
my experience with Kings of Leon is interesting because I saw them on their first tour, or one of their first tours, when their first record, Youth and Young Manhood, came out, and I just was completely unimpressed. And they were doing more of this Strokes meets Skinner type of thing that they were criticized for, and they were dressed up in period Southern gentleman wear. And none of the sincerity that's emerged in their music since then was present at that time when I first saw them, and I dismissed them. And when their second record came out, I'll give anyone a second chance, I was so impressed by kind of the level of growth and maturation that I saw in the songwriting that I made an effort to go see them a second time. And the second time became a third time, and the third time became a fourth time. And, you know, I really saw that there was something a lot more going on to them, other than, like we were talking about earlier, them just being an indie band with one album, you know, not really having a chance to capitalize on more than that.
I said that they sound more comfortable being on this new label, but I did see a YouTube video that they posted, and the lead singer's talking about how one of the songs that they recorded on the new record, he was so drunk the night that they recorded it, he actually didn't remember that they had recorded it when they said that that was a contender for the album. And when they played it for him, he said he was brought to tears because most of the lyrics, he said he was really drunk. And I mean, like, historic drunk. That a lot of the stuff was just coming off the top of his head. And that even though they could record it again, perhaps better, he said he just wouldn't want to, because what he was hearing was almost third-party listening. He could hear this person who was at the edge of their life and who had a lot of things to work out. And the nuance and everything else in that performance was just something that he said, I can't repeat this, so, you know, let's go with it. So that, I mean, that's the contrast to what I'm saying about, you know, they're now, how many records in? Three, four records in?
Four records in. And you know, just in my kind of limited worldview, I'd have to say that this record, more so than any other, feels less like the Kings of Leon as artists, as I've experienced them and alive and kind of appreciating the recordings experience. And more kind of a band that is behaving like the Kings of Leon. So, you know, we'll see. Maybe the album's a grower. I've only had a chance to listen to it six or seven times. But for sure, to see them live is really, it's really something else. I mean, they project a lot, and you can see kind of where the songwriting drive comes from. I mean, these guys had a very interesting upbringing, and, you know, the cliche about rock and roll being the ultimate form of rebellion, I guess shy of becoming a Republican or using heroin, is still true today. And it all comes out in their music, and it's really something to see.
Yeah, I hope that record is the grower that you're talking about, because it sounds a little safer, a little more subdued. But then again, great artists like that have a way of surprising you. These guys are not making these records by mistake. There's a lot of stuff that goes into being great. And I'm sure that that's all built in there somewhere.
Going back to what we were talking about earlier, here we have a band that kind of has gotten through those first learning curves and kind of the maturation process. And now there is a brand, Kings of Leon. And they have a lot of people working for them and working with them and helping them make decisions. And sometimes that career by committee can squelch a lot of the inspiration, a lot of the purity about what comes out of an artist.
No doubt. I hope MGMT brings to the stage more what I felt on that debut album of theirs, because that record is so raw and so inspired and so interesting and carefree, but the lyrics are sincere and interesting and profound in a lot of ways. I really hope that they don't ever get the life squeezed out of them in the same way. You know, making a band like MGMT safer or more accessible would be the ultimate mistake.
One of the artists I'm going to see tomorrow night, Keenan Bell, is this emergent pop artist here in Los Angeles. What's interesting is that he's playing at Spaceland. Not only is he playing at Spaceland, he's actually doing the Monday Night Residency for the month, which is unusual for Spaceland. They tend to revel in you know, indie rock bands. That's pretty much their bread and butter. But if you go to his MySpace, one of the songs you'll hear is him basically contributing to or improving upon, however you want to look at it, a track by MGMT. So here we have a group that kind of has already transcended the context of being like a pop rock white fan base soundtrack to the summer type of thing, and we have other artists, more diverse artists, looking at them and finding benefit in what they've done.
Oh, because it's a soul record. I mean, it just is through and through. It's a soul album.
That exactly right. That's the you know, that's a good benchmark for an artist that we know we're going to be able to expect some better and greater things down the road.
Another thing about Los Angeles that's amazing and why we cover the music scene here so extensively is because it's really not just relegated to the Silver Lake Lounge. Although it's produced a lot of great acts, and as is Spaceland and all of that, you have the whole glitch scene that comes in, and it's cross-pollinated with the electro scene in San Francisco, and that goes back and forth in this crazy exchange. You've got the Glitch Mob and Edit. You have brilliant albums like Flying Lotus that just came out of Los Angeles and has just topped all the critics' charts for good reason. And then you get, you know, hip-hop residencies at Spaceland that happen and are always reinvigorating the scene. So it's an amazing place. There's a huge cross-section of people. It's extremely ethnically diverse. And everyone's sort of duking it out for the spotlight, but always having to do so by being really just the best. There's not a lot of pretense down in the trenches, let's call it, despite the fact that on top of it, there's this veneer of the desperate corporations trying to clamor for your attention. So we're going to try to keep that real and exciting by just presenting it to you as we see it out of Los Angeles at musiczeitgeist.com blog. And there will certainly be another part to this discussion, and I want to thank our intrepid writer, Truffle Jones, for coming down today and having a long chat with us, but a needed chat. And you're only 3/4 of the way through your week of show, so we're going to have a couple more to cover.
Yeah, a couple more tonight, tomorrow night, and then Tuesday night. Again, it's a group we've already covered here, so there probably won't be a review, but Margo and the Nuclear So-and-Sos playing at the Troubadour, doing something that's actually unprecedented in the music industry, releasing two albums on the same day, one an album that Epic Records did not want to release, and one is the Epic Records preferred release. They came to a compromise, and they're both releasing them at the same time. It's going to be really interesting to see what the sales stats are on those two records. We'll find out if the artist was right or if the record label was right. But regardless, Tuesday night at the Troubadour, it's going to be a great show.
Well, that'll be certainly an illuminating exercise in how this new music paradigm is actually going down.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. My name is Karam. You've been listening to the KaramCast.com. If you like this episode, please visit us at iTunes and subscribe. Feel free to write in at info@karamcast.com with your comments, complaints, suggestions for future episodes, and thanks a lot for listening.